Well, I had the pleasure of meeting Bernard this afternoon. We hadn't crossed paths, and so we had about a 90-minute conversation over dinner. And if we either of us had some anticipation of finding really good points to spar on, you know, we are both, I think, gravely disappointed in the sense that we just found one point after another that was point of common ground, of convergence. But, of course, from very different life stories, because I disengaged, I abandoned Western academia when I was 20, 21 years old and took a 14-year hiatus from Western academia, became a Buddhist monk and all of that, and eventually wound back, come back studying physics and so on. Whereas Bernard has followed the straight track, but, of course, a very unusual one. And so my talk here, we agreed beforehand that I would get a sense of the slides he would show so I could respond in a way that would be very coherent, and then I made my slides independent upon his so we can anticipate each other. So I will go through my slides fairly briefly because I'm kind of eager to get to the end of them, not that I want to finish, but to really highlight and to elaborate how can we move ahead empirically. There's many quotes. I'm going to share quotes that I think are provocative in accordance with the many shown here. But how can we, to use a term from a neuroscientific research and so on, operationalize? We have these, I believe, very profound statements made by a number of people. But how can you put this to the test of experience? And I'm convinced that the way ahead is by taking a radically empirical stance or approach, which is precisely the opposite of a dogmatic, closed-minded, fundamentalist approach. And I think, as Bernard has so rightly said, we find such a mindset in religion, which is very famous for that, religious fundamentalism, East and West, but we find also a kind of ersatz religious fundamentalism within the scientific community, within academia, but also, for that matter, in the media, the popular media, that often, in many, many cases, accepts materialism as a God-given truth. And so this is the approach I would like to take. One of my intellectual heroes is William James. But as Bernard started with personal history, I would guess I would make just a one-liner. Bernard spoke of this pivotal point when he was 15. For me, it was when I was 13. But it wasn't reading Lobsang Rampo or Psi Phenomena or Relativity. It was finding a science teacher that just thrilled me with the love of nature, the wish to know reality, ecology, and that. And so I was, from the age of 13, really focused on pursuing a career in science. And then by the age of 20, became disillusioned because although there were many facts, I found nothing in terms of meaning, a meaningful way of life that I would find satisfying. I was raised in a Christian family. There's plenty of meaning, for sure, in the Christian faith. But there were just too many statements that I simply could not regard as factual. So I was caught in between, wanting to lead a life that was authentic, rooted in reality, of facts, of knowledge, that it was at the same time meaningful. And from my perspective, at the age of 20, you could have meaning or facts, but you couldn't have both. So I left, with no interest in Western civilization. And it wasn't until about 14 years later that I came back, did my studies in physics and so forth at Amherst, and then religious studies at Stanford. That's my little personal history. I'd like to step back now and go very, very briefly, just dot by dot, in the evolution of modern science. Going back to Galileo, I'd like to highlight him more than Copernicus because he was the first full-fledged scientist. He was a mathematician, an experimenter. He was very careful, made very careful observations, hypotheses, and made his own technology, most of which Copernicus did not do. And so I think he, more than anyone else, receives the credit from Einstein and many other people for being the father of modern science, for really setting modern natural science on its course. And I would suggest that a key element of what he unprecedentedly introduced was the rigorous observation of physical and celestial and terrestrial physical phenomena. By the careful observation and finding technology to make rigorous, precise, replicable observations, the likes of which no one had ever done before, the use of the telescope as a scientific instrument, and triggered the first revolution in the physical sciences, in all of science, and it was in physics. And although there are many ingredients to his approach, the precise observation of the phenomena he was seeking to understand, terrestrial physical phenomena, celestial physical phenomena, truly the father of modern science. This was so a seminal year, 1609. I think that's when his Starry Messenger was published. 250 years later, to the year, Darwin published his work, Origin of Species, set off another revolution, and I say in principle there was very profound common ground, the rigorous, precise observation of the phenomena he was seeking to understand. And he did it by years and years of research. In England, his famous voyage circumnavigating the Earth and so forth. And these are true revolutions, I think, in the following way. If a revolution occurs, if you really understand the import of Galileo's discoveries, and he gave the first empirical evidence that the geocentric view was false, was hopeless, it was done, and that was by observing the phases of Venus, you can never look at the universe in the same way. You cannot look at planet Earth in the same way if you've understood the revolution that he triggered. And likewise, you can't look at human life and life on the planet in the same way if you've understood the insights and the implications of Darwin and his theory of evolution. Everything's changed, and you can't go back. You can't become a pre-Darwinian after you become a Darwinian. Now, about 125 years ago, then William James suggested a similar approach when it came to the study of the mind, which, oddly enough, the scientific, empirical, experimental study of the mind had been postponed for 300 years. Almost 300 years, from 300 years from the time of Copernicus. It was the whoops moment, as Bernard was so rightly saying. Lord Kelvin thought they pretty much had everything wrapped up in the latter part of the 19th century. We're done here, don't go into physics, we're finished. And it was exactly that time, 1875 or so, that the scientific study of the mind began. 300 years went by. And William James proposed that we take a similarly radically empirical approach to studying the mind, in which introspection would be our primary avenue of inquiry. And it should be refined, replicable, and that should be it. We should, you know, take a radically empirical approach to the mind. Well, 100 years ago, that view of empiricism, of introspection, of taking the phenomena of first-person experience very seriously was, beaten to death by the rise of behavioral psychology, the insistence that psychologists, behavioral psychologists, not even refer to first-person experience and never use introspection. So it was like starting a new branch of astronomy in which you insist nobody talks about stars or planets and never use a telescope. And oddly enough, they were very successful. William James' approach submerged and has never resurfaced. And so they just moved on and decided to study the mind by looking in the opposite direction from the mind, outwards to the physical, quantifiable, and objective, whereas the mind is subjective, non-physical, and qualitative. And I would suggest that what could have been the seeds for a true revolution in the mind sciences, triggered by William James, Wilhelm Wundt, and other pioneers of modern psychology, it was stifled by the refusal to follow the method of Galileo and Darwin of observing carefully the phenomena you're seeking to understand. It was stifled because it was incompatible with the beliefs of scientists, in which Bernard has already clearly presented. The facts were incompatible with dogma, so throw out the facts. So this is very brief, so we've seen this, and now just a rephrasing. It was interesting that Bernard, really, he and I quite independently, we have a number of overlapping slides, just very quickly. Scientism. Here it is. Scientific inquiry must confine itself to investigating objective, physical, quantifiable phenomena. If you look anywhere else, you're into la-la land, you're into pseudoscience, you're into something that's just not science at all, but that means the only thing that exists are objective, physical, and quantifiable. The universe consists only, here's the methodological insistence, then the ontological insistence, the universe consists only of what scientists can measure, which does sound suspicious, and science is the only way to understand human nature and the universe at large. This sounds like religious fundamentalism. Have you ever heard in a religious context, we have the only way? We have the only way. And by the way, we may have to kill you if you disagree. So this is what came up, and it really is a form of religious fundamentalism. And I understand that I'm at ease with religious fundamentalism. It's been around for a long time. And so I'm not really upset by that. But I must say I'm deeply concerned when what is really simply a form of religious fundamentalism is presented as scientific fact. And that upsets me in the sense that I love science and I abhor dogmatic, closed-minded fundamentalism. And when the two are put in bed together, it's very unsavory. What's come out of this as again, this is just complementary to Bernard's talk, is that a blind, what I call a blind spot in the scientific understanding of consciousness. The science of the mind, empirical, experimental science of the mind, has been going on for about 135 years now. And the behaviorists, when they came along, they said, well, we won't even talk about consciousness. How about that? That's a good strategy. And when neuroscience, as a discipline, began, it began, as they defined the term in 1963 and established it as an academic discipline, they simply made, like legislation, like parliament calling something into law, they simply said, let's treat mind as a biological phenomena. They didn't give any evidence. There was no paper. There was no study. They just said, let's just do it. Shall we agree? It's like in Britain, you just simply decide to drive on the left-hand side of the road. You don't have to find evidence for that effect. You just say, let's do it. We know it's odd, but, you know, who needs a continent? And so you simply decide, you know. You simply decide, but that's not how science operates. But that's exactly what the neuroscientific community did. They just treated the mind-body problem as if it didn't exist, as if it had been solved somehow, sometime, with some study, and it never had. There were a bunch of politicians that simply took over mind and made it brain. And lo and behold, the media has gone along with this like, I don't know, puppies lapping up milk. I wish that there had is such a thing as investigative journalism in the coverage of science, but I think it's dead. What's come out of this is even now, there is no scientific definition of consciousness. I think there are about 200 of them, which means no consensus. There's no objective means of detecting consciousness in anything or any mental phenomena at all. We don't know what the neural correlates of consciousness are. If there is a minimal degree of neuronal activity that is needed to produce consciousness, don't know what they are. We don't know the necessary causing conditions of consciousness. We don't know how the brain, if it does, generates or even influences mental phenomena, or how the mind, as in the placebo effect in so many other ways, influences the brain. In other words, all the fundamental, most important questions about the mind have been simply unaddressed and treated as if we already know them. This is why I call it a blind spot, like a retinal blind spot, where you don't know what you don't know, and you have an illusion of knowledge, of thinking you know that about which you're completely ignorant. That's not science. That's the opposite of science. So Sigmund Freud ran on this point. He had a very low estimation of religion altogether. The future of an illusion is the illusion of religion. But he did make this comment, 1927, the problem of the world constitution, of a world constitution, a theory of the universe that takes no account of the mental apparatus by which we perceive it, is an empty abstraction of no practical interest. Well, when I studied cosmology, what I was astonished to find is you'd have an 800-page book on cosmology and no reference to mind or consciousness anywhere. Like, it was so inconsequential that who cares? It doesn't matter. After all, we know it's only epiphenomenal. But that was not a scientific conclusion. That's just what people started to say. And so it's pseudoscience presenting itself as science. And so Freud is saying, if you have a vision of the universe and we have no explanation how mind arose, what's the role of mind, then this is an empty abstraction. And it's describing, in fact, a universe that doesn't exist. Because the universe that does exist is one in which mind is present, consciousness is present, and you've treated it as if it's a mindless universe. That's not science. So I congratulate Freud on that, but then you immediately say, well, then your science is an illusion, because the science does exactly that, presents a vision of reality with no account of the mind, and then he counters it, and he says, no, our science is not an illusion. Well, then you just said it is, and now you say it's not. But then he said, what would be an illusion would be to think that we might obtain elsewhere what science cannot give us. In other words, it's fundamentalism all over. If our religion doesn't have it, it can't be important. But heaven's sakes, don't look outside. And that's what religious fundamentalism is saying forever. So I call that out with the old of sacrificing truth for the sake of protecting turf. That the only way to know reality is science. But that's like the only way to salvation is Christianity, the only way to liberation is Buddhism. So in with the new, and lo and behold, we get this from a mainstream, quite distinguished physicist at Stanford University, my alma mater, Andrei Linde, a Russian physicist, but has been doing research for many years in the United States. And he writes, I'll read just right through it, will it not turn out with the further development of science that the study of the universe and the study of consciousness will be inseparably linked, and that ultimate progress in the one will be impossible without progress in the other? It's a juicy question. At the development of a unified geometrical description of the weak, strong electromagnetic and gravitational interactions, the four forces, will the next important step not be the development of a unified approach to our entire world, including the world of consciousness? So you see, in our very independent trajectories, Bernard and I, we're coming to really utterly common ground, looking ahead in the same direction. And to my mind, William James really is still a beacon of light here, because he was wonderfully multifaceted, a true polymath, and wonderfully, homogeneously non-dogmatic. And so he coined this term, radical empiricism, or at least he popularized it. And again, his articulation of this is very useful, worth reading. I say empiricism because it is contented to regard its most assured conclusions, such as everything boils down to matter, or the only real things are physical things. Nature equals the physical universe. That's an assured conclusion. But we regard our most assured conclusions concerning matters of fact as hypotheses liable to modification in the course of future experience. So empiricism, he's coming back to experience, and dogma, be damned. And I say radical because it treats the doctrine of monism, that's what we call scientific materialism, or scientism, which you know now well, we treat this itself as a hypothesis. And unlike so much of the halfway empiricism, where you're willing to be empirical just to the point that you don't contradict materialism, that is current under the name of positivism, agnosticism, or scientific naturalism, which is again materialism. It does not radical empiricism does not dogmatically affirm scientific materialism or monism as something with which all experience has got to square. So as Bernard knows very well, a lot of mainstream scientists won't even look in the direction of psi phenomena and so forth, because they say, well, that can't possibly be true, so we don't need to look, because that contradicts our beliefs, which is, of course, exactly what the dogmatic minds in the Roman Catholic Church and the scholastics in the universities in Europe said of Galileo's work. That can't possibly be true, therefore we don't need to look through your telescope. Because if we did, and we saw something that contradicts our views, we know that's going to be an optical illusion. And also, if I drew conclusions, I'd lose my job. So there were two theoretical, empirical reasons for contemporaries of Galileo to refuse to look through the telescope, like psychologists to this day, not all, but most mainstream psychologists, refuse to include introspection, even very refined introspection, in the repertoire, because you might just observe something non-physical. And that could really upset the apple cart. So William James, this is the conclusion of his Psychology, A Briefer Course. It's a long quote, but it's juicy, and I'm going to read it. At present, psychology is in the condition of physics before Galileo and the laws of motion, of chemistry before Lavoisier and the notion that mass is preserved in all reactions. The Galileo and the Lavoisier of psychology will be famous men indeed when they come, as come they someday surely will, or past successes are no index to the future. When they do come, however, the necessities of the case will make them metaphysical, which means heretical. Meanwhile, the best way in which we can facilitate their advent is to understand how great is the darkness in which we grope, and never to forget that the natural science assumptions with which we started are provisional and revisable things. When the scientific study of the mind began, what dominated European, especially English and American science was the metaphysical beliefs of materialism. They already dominated. To question them was to put yourself on thin ice, and that's what he's exactly referring to. These are starting assumptions, but let empiricism put those to the test of experience. Now, if there was just one point that I would differ, and gladly and with a very relaxed state of mind, from Bernard's talk, it would be the casual reference, which is widely held and almost very frequently never even challenged, that what I've been talking about here is science, 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 and then there's religion. And among the religions, we know there are world religions, not just one now, and the classification of Buddhism as a religion, as if we've nailed it, we found the correct box to put it in. In academia, which department, if you've got something here you have to study, there's Buddhism, where do you put it? In the psychology department, in philosophy department, and early on, the Western academics who went to Asia and studied what was there found monks, incense, rituals, chanting, temples, and they just kind of said, yeah, that works. It's a religion. It's an ethnocentric projection of our terminology on another culture in which the word religion doesn't even exist. So I think there's no doubt about it that within the Buddhist tradition, this very multifaceted phenomenon evolving, changing, transmuting over, or mutating over 2,500 years, there's no question that it has religious elements. There's no question. I have no problem with that. I am religious. But we see that superficially. And what we don't see is what are the monks, the nuns, the other yogis doing when they're sitting quietly? Are they practicing religion? And I would say, well, some of them are. But there are scientific elements in the Buddhist tradition from the very beginning. It did not start out as a religion. We define that term, not the Buddha or Indians or Chinese. And so Buddhism has scientific elements from the very beginning. It has philosophical elements from the very beginning. It doesn't fit into our categories. And we need to jump out of our ethnocentric appraisal of other traditions and begin to take them on their own ground and see strengths in the other that we don't have. And one of the non-strengths of Western civilization, especially since Galileo, but it goes back earlier than that, is something that is one of the great strengths and contributions to world civilization from India, and that's the discovery, the development, and refinement of what Indians call samadhi. And we are terrible at it in the West. It's one of our greatest strengths, limitations, weaknesses. We're living in an ADHD world, and it's the Eurocentric American-European baby that we've set the whole world bonkers in terms of our attention skills. It's just getting worse and worse and worse, and we created it. And in contrast to that, you go to India, you can go back 4,000 years ago at least, and you'll find that there were generations and generations, they were men only at that time, they were only the ones allowed, that stepped out of mainstream culture and were in the pursuit of truth and freedom, and they had to be both. Not just freedom as in salvation, based on blind faith, belief, grace, and so forth, but truth and freedom, and the two had to be together, and it had to be empirical. And a set of skills they developed without parallel and without precedent was the skills of samadhi. What happens when you learn how to hone your attention skills, concentration skills? Is there an upper limit to which you can hone your attention like a laser? And is it good for you? Does it make you a zombie? How significant is that? The development of samadhi was extremely well developed at the time of the Buddha. It was already a very advanced discipline. And so the Gautama, who became the Buddha, adopted certain of the techniques from the generations and generations before him. He refined them himself, I think, somewhat analogous to, not a close analogy, but not bad, to Galileo, who did not invent the telescope. It was already been invented by the Dutch. But he adopted it, refined it, and then, unprecedentedly, Galileo used this instrument as a scientific instrument, which the Dutch had not done. In a similar fashion, I think it's not a bad parallel, Gautama took samadhi, which had been primarily taken as an end in itself. What state of peace, of serenity, of transcendence, of inner silence can you ascend to by going deeper, deeper, up and down into samadhi? And Gautama did something unprecedented. He refined the attention skills to extraordinary degree, the likes of which we haven't even approached even remotely in modern science. We're extremely primitive level. And he took that and then united that, the shamatha, which is the refinement of attention skills, with vipassana, the act of inquiry into the nature of mind and its role in nature, and made, I am persuaded, one extraordinary discovery after another. The first of which is he penetrated through the layers of his psyche, the most superficial layer of the mind, to a ground continuum of consciousness from which the psyche emerges. The notion that mind emerges from neurons is magical physics, magical biology. The notion that dreams, thoughts, and images actually come from chemicals and electricity is one of the craziest ideas that's ever become popular. And there's no evidence for it. People just start talking that way with no evidence for it. It doesn't, by the way. The mind emerges from a subtle continuum of consciousness, and what Gautama found, there were precedents for them, but I think he explored more deeply than anyone before, is he looked back and he said, I saw with direct knowledge, I directly perceived countless of my own past lifetimes. And it wasn't by simply being an anomalous child who somehow inexplicably has past life recall. He did this by very rigorous training. And it was an experiment, and he ran it, and he could not find any initial first lifetime. And so the notion, as Bernard was already suggesting, that perhaps through contemplative training, by way of the mind, you may be able to perceive elements of the physical universe and its evolution, becomes quite reasonable. If you can remember, remember experiences you had 10,000 lifetimes ago, well, the universe would have been a different condition. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And so, but overall, the whole Buddhist tradition for the last 2,500 years has basically come up with, I think it's fair to say, nothing in terms of technology. If you go to Tibet, and I've lived with Tibetans for many years, I think their most sophisticated technology is a prayer wheel. They do work very well, very well. But I don't see them coming out with 2.0 and 3.0. They're not really getting better. We in the West, we've got them now on electricity, so you don't even have to go like this. You can just turn it on and walk away and think about sex. I guess that's progress, but I'm not really sure. But in terms of Tibetan-made prayer wheels, I mean, they just, you know, they got as good as they wanted, and they said, you know, this is good enough, and they stopped. It would be like Steve Jobs saying, you know, I got an iPhone, what do you need? You know, we'll just stop. You happy with the iPhone? Come on, why don't you just stop? You know, shut down Apple. Everybody happy now? I think we can shut down. Happy with your laptop? I am. I don't need a better one. Why don't we just stop and say, thanks a million, but, you know, it's good enough. What the Tibetans have is, for the most contemplative civilization on the planet, many of them, certainly not the whole community, is an insatiable appetite and curiosity for exploring the mind firsthand, and a very easily satisfied appetite for the external. They're happy. If you got a yak, what do you need a car for? If you got a horse, why do you need a motorcycle? And if you don't have any horses, who needs roads? And so they're very happy to have no roads, because they say, well, then we'd have to repair them and all of that. Why not just have a trail and ride your horse? They're much nicer to you than a motorcycle is. And so here's the technology. We all know, William James knew, we know, everybody knows pretty much if they've been paying attention, introspection is fallible. You can get false impressions, you can draw false conclusions, but what we haven't even taken into account as a possibility in our very sophisticated and incredibly crude civilization, and I say that as an insider, so I get to criticize my own civilization, is can introspection be refined? Can it be made rigorous? Can it be fully incorporated into scientific inquiry? And I'd have to say we're not even close to it. So this leads to discovery. What I'm interested in is moving ahead and seeing exactly as Bernard said, how can we, you know, just move away from the so-called science-religion wars, all the basically sticking out of tongues at each other, which happens from the religious fundamentalist side. In America, 42% of Americans believe the universe was created less than 10,000 years ago. I think that's called to all of cosmology, 10,000 years ago. And then human beings were created as we were shortly thereafter, to all of biology. It's like, we don't like you, and we're going to ignore you, and that's 42% of the population. If you're wondering about the presidential election, you know who they're voting for. And so I'm not interested in that. I find it boring versus boring. Religious fundamentalists and materialist fundamentalists beating it out, and in fact, empowering each other. Empowering each other. The more scientists, this is, I think, a strong hypothesis, the more mainstream scientists insists that you have to accept materialism, the more they alienate very large portions of the population that then totally turn off to science and are quite happy to try to rip apart our civilization altogether. So I think the insistence of the conflation of scientific materialism and science is a major cause of the radicalism, terrorism, and sheer stupidity that we're seeing in religious traditions nowadays, in religious fundamentalism. But now let's get on to the mind. My time also is limited. Try not to, because I am looking forward to conversation, but I'm trying to give us grist for the mill here. What I'm suggesting here in the whole notion of multiple dimensions is that the mind has multiple dimensions, most of which we have remained unexplored by us in the modern world, in mainstream academia, academic psychology. But the first one is one where there's a good deal of knowledge. Let's just call it the psyche. The first dimension, the flat dimension, And this is the embodied mind, the mind that is profoundly influenced by brain, genetics, the whole physiology, the environment, the physical environment, acculturation, thoroughly embodied. It includes conscious and unconscious mental processes and conditioned by all of these things, including, of course, the brain, the physical environment, society, for that matter. So there it is, something we all know that exists, that is being studied. It's being studied primarily in modern academic psychology by studying behavior, including interviewing people, and brain. And the brain scientists are really trying to do almost like a hostile takeover, or one company just taking over another. The brain scientists are really trying to take over the whole show and say, we'll provide you with all the answers. Just everybody pipe down and let all the money flow to us. So there's a lot of self-serving attitude of neuroscientists telling us that by understanding the brain, they'll fathom the nature of human nature, tell us whether we have free will, what is the nature of the mind, its role in nature, what happens at death, what happens at birth. In fact, we'll answer all your questions and just give us more money. It's actually a lot of very misleading propaganda. And so this psyche, this first dimension, can be studied indirectly by interrogation, done all the time, examining brain and behavior, done all the time. But where Buddhism is strong, contemplative tradition is strong, and Western science is just flat out weak, like in its diapers, is exploring the mind through introspection, but refined introspection. And that means you must develop samadhi, and that can take thousands of hours of training. But at least it's something familiar, and we can approach it from multiple perspectives, brain, behavior, and introspection. And this is what William James proposed more than 100 years ago. This is a three-dimensional, non-dogmatic, radically empirical approach. Primarily study the mind by way of observing it, like Galileo and Darwin for their disciplines. Secondarily, study the mind by way of its behavioral expressions and neuroscientific correlates. And then, of course, his got thrown out. Behaviorism had 50 years of domination, thrown out, at least certainly put in its place, and now the brain scientists are dominating the media. But in so doing, if you insist on looking outwards to the mind, which is inwards, then you'll miss everything but what I call the flat mind approach to studying the psyche, studying consciousness, like flat earth. You see only the superficial, most superficial dimension. Penetrate beyond that, which you can only do by looking inwards and not like by looking at brain or behavior. And you discover a whole other dimension of consciousness. This is a subtle dimension of consciousness in which all sensory appearances, thoughts, and mental images have disappeared. And it's naturally accessed, this more subtle continuum, in deep dreamless sleep, at the point of death, when your brain is shut down, flatlined, and in very deep samadhi. You penetrate to this, but normally the only way you access this consciously, lucidly, knowingly, and can really make discoveries is not just by falling asleep, because you don't even know you're asleep, not at death, if you know anything, you don't get a report, but samadhi that you can survive and come back and tell the tale. The hypothesis here, and that's the way I want to approach this, not as a really good pitch and trying to be, I don't know, persuasive and charismatic and convert you. I have no interest in that. But rather, how can this be subject to experimentation that can be replicable and can be done in full-scale collaboration with open-minded scientists? And I know there are more than one here, but here's one that I have already come to greatly admire. People who are first-rate scientists, but are so daring as to have open minds, which can be a very dangerous thing to do. You can put your career at danger. And we've had a brief discussion, I think more in America than here. You can really imperil your whole career, your funding, your reputation, your status, your job, if you question materialism in many fields. Neuroscience is one of them. If you enter that discipline, beware. If you start speaking like Bernard, you might find yourself driving a taxi. So, happily, he still has his job. And so this ground state, here's the hypothesis, that it is subtle continuum of individual consciousness, it's not collective unconscious, from which all mental activities emerge in the formation of a human embryo, emerge when you're waking up from deep sleep, and into which they dissolve when you die, when you fall deep asleep, when you go into deep samadhi, and it's this continuum that carries on from lifetime to lifetime. That's the hypothesis. Well, that sounds like religion, sounds like metaphysics, it sounds like mysticism, it sounds like, a lot of people would say la-la land and so forth, but they say, okay, but where's your evidence? And I say, well, your evidence is you can directly perceive the subtle continuum, which is transpersonal. That is, you're not looking in somebody else's, but it's not a human continuum. It is prior to the formation of the human mind and your sense of identity, as a stem cell is to well-configured cells like bone marrow, neurons, and so forth. This substrate consciousness subtle continuum is a stem consciousness, not yet configured when you're resting in it as human or any other species. So it can be directly seen, just like Galileo directly saw the phases of Venus and blew away 1,400 years of assumption about the Earth being in the center. This can be directly perceived. But it can be inferred indirectly from a third-person perspective, those who are not ready to become professional meditators, requiring 5, 10, 15, 20,000 hours of training, like getting a PhD in astronomy and physics. How many hours? 5, 10, 15,000. If you would like to do it indirectly, then you can do this on the basis of verbal reports, behavior, and physiological signs of past lives and near-death experiences. And I'm sure that Bernard has looked into this more closely than I, but I have looked into it. And if one looks into an open mind, there is just very compelling evidence. You can't just whisk away and say, this is pseudoscience, these are mushy-woolly thinkers, and so forth. I know many people that adopt that view. But I asked Jim Tucker, and I've known each other for some years. He's the protege of the late Ian Stevenson. They've been doing this research for 40 years. It's very, very good research. And I asked Jim just a few months ago by email, Jim, in the 40 years you've been doing this research and all the books that Bernard showed on the screen, I said, have you ever received from a mainstream scientist an open-minded, critical assessment, evaluation of this research that shows its strength and its weaknesses? Have you ever gotten a fair-minded, open, critical review published in any scientific journal? The answer was, never. 40 years of research. That, to my mind, is a salutation to their research and a very severe condemnation of a whole academic community that refuses even to look, because that evidence could really torpedo their most cherished beliefs, that they know how the universe is. I think we all take refuge in the notion, I know what's going on, I know I've got it, I know how the universe works. And if your whole worldview and your sense of your own identity is rooted in materialism, how eager are you going to be to make a sham of your entire professional career based upon falsehood? So this is an empirical issue. It can be put to empirical test. We go to the deepest level. This is where we're going into the deepest waters, into cosmology, into questions that Bernard was raising. Can you, through contemplative inquiry, did the Buddha himself have insights about the nature of the universe at large, coming through, call it extrasensory perception, clairvoyance, coming through contemplative inquiry, right down to the deepest ground of awareness? And in the Buddhist view, there are three dimensions. This is the simpler view. There are more dimensions. One can speak of 10 dimensions of consciousness. Not 11, you got one. But ours include consciousness, and the 11 don't. So 10 dimensions. But if we simplify that down to three, we have the psyche, this subtle continuum individuated that carries imprints, memories, predilections, many other qualities from lifetime to lifetime. But if you cut through that, then there is a third dimension. And this is the dimension. I'm a doctorate in comparative religion, comparative mysticism. And ever since I read Aldous Huxley's The Perennial Philosophy, and then years later picked up The Transcendent Unity of Religions by Schoen, my working hypothesis has been for the last 45 years that when we take any of the great spiritual traditions of the world and we go to the greatest depths of their experiential insights, that they're converging upon a common reality. Houston Smith was a friend of mine. He took that view. Ninian Smart, an outstanding, he was a Scot, passed away, very dear friend of mine. We taught in the same university. That's his working hypothesis. These are two of the finest comparative scholars of religion in the 20th century, Houston Smith and Ninian Smart. They're absolutely first rate. They took this view. And that's been my working hypothesis. And it's this point, this third dimension, which is transcendent, it's sacred, it's divine, that I believe the great religious traditions are converging in upon. Some go closer, some a bit farther away. But like the vanishing point in perspectival drawing, converging upon a point. A third dimension, an ultimate atemporal. So again, the dovetailing with Bernard's talk. Ultimate, atemporal, non-local, an ultimate ground state of consciousness that pervades all phenomena, transcends all concepts, transcends the intellect, can be known, but not by the intellect, can be known, but not by way of concepts, can be known, but what level of consciousness is it that knows this deepest dimension? The deepest dimension. The deeper can fathom the subtle, the more superficial. The more superficial cannot fathom the deeper. There's an asymmetry there. And it's non-dual, this deepest dimension, which is divine. One could say this, that Meister Eckhart, when he's speaking of the God beyond the Trinity, the Advaita Vedanta, the ultimate union of Brahman and Atman, in the Dzogchen view, primordial consciousness, Buddha mind, pristine awareness, non-dual from the ground of being, the ultimate nature of existence itself, which has everything to do with entanglement, and the energy of primordial consciousness, which is that kind of the Ur energy, from which all other forms of energy and forces, strong force, weak force, and so forth, are derivative. And on the ultimate ground, this ultimate space called Dharma Dhatu, or the absolute space of phenomena, not to be confused with Newton's absolute space of phenomena, which is synonymous with emptiness, shunyata, primordial consciousness, and the energy of primordial consciousness, it's the Buddhist Trinity. All these are the ground of being, and they're indivisible. So coming to a conclusion here, that sounds like really good mystical philosophy, but does anybody know what they're talking about? We had that statement, it caught my eye, by Stuart Kaufman, who I met years ago, that said, I don't quote it here, but I know what the gist of it, I don't know what consciousness is, nobody does. Well, you'd have to be omniscient for that to be a valid statement. How do you know what everybody else knows? I find it embarrassing as a Westerner that our civilization, our Eurocentric civilization, is so ridiculously ethnocentric in the 21st century. As if we just don't have a clue what the Chinese were saying, except for they got fireworks right. And we don't know what the Indians said, except for they did invent zero, and thank you for that. And your numerical system worked a lot better than Roman numerals, so thank you. But we're done with you now, because we're carrying the ball for the last 500 years. As if we're the only civilization that's ever had anything to say about anything. And if we don't know it, nobody knows it. That's exactly what Stuart Kaufman was saying. I don't know it. Nobody knows it. And the Buddhists, Hindus, well, who are they? I mean, they're not us. They're pre-scientific, right? Which means, what could they know? And I find that really quite distasteful. I think that would be a good British term, wouldn't it? Distasteful. That we should grow up. I mean, it's the 21st century, for heaven's sakes. When you couldn't get to Asia without spending, a month or two in a boat, then you kind of understand. William James never went to India. Too much of an ordeal. But, with a couple of $1,000, you can travel from anywhere to anywhere. What's the excuse? And so much fantastic literature translated in English and German and French, Italian, and so on. We have no excuse with this type of ridiculous ethnocentricity where we assume if we don't know, nobody else knows. As if no other civilization has strength that we don't. And this permeates the scientific study of meditation, in which I've been involved since 1992. The meditators are subjects, the professional scientists. They ask the meditators to put things on their head and answer questionnaires, study their brains. The scientists go off and report their findings, and they never ask the meditators, have you discovered anything? Anybody in your tradition over the last 2,500 years ever discovered anything? So I find that embarrassing. That we're not treating these people, some of whom have been trained in meditation for 40,000 hours, we're not treating them as professionals, we're treating them as two-legged guinea pigs whose brains and behavior we will study. So I think it's time for a big move beyond that. But Bernard was asking, speaking that there is credible evidence of those various things you mentioned, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, and the whole list you gave. Of psychokinesis, of telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, you didn't mention, otherness. But then if that's true, how do we make it intelligible? Because it's not enough to have evidence. Science moves only when you have a theory to make the evidence intelligible. It doesn't move just by having anomalous evidence. So for past life recall, these children, the second dimension covers it. That those children, for whatever reasons, for a short time, usually it's gone by age of 8, they are having veridical memories of past lives that have been tested, and it's been found that they have knowledge that they have no business knowing unless they really were the person they say they're recalling being. So that level of past life recall, that can be understood with just the second dimension. But how on earth could we know, directly perceive events taking place distant in space that are occurring right now? Because your we'll call it substrate consciousness, that continuum, isn't there. It's local. How can anybody know the future? Because your substrate consciousness hasn't been there yet. How can you know other people's minds? Your substrate consciousness is over here, somebody else's consciousness over there. Entangled, but not the same thing. And so I think to make the phenomena intelligible is what Newton did, Maxwell did, Einstein did, Heisenberg did. You've got these anomalous phenomena. Make them intelligible. Don't just say, wow, that's an anomaly. And for that, we have to invoke a third dimension, a dimension of consciousness that is non-local and atemporal, to which we can tap in. And that you tap into, if you want to do it in a replicable, rigorous way, you need samadhi. What we have thus far is gifted people cropping up here and there, but we don't know how they got that way. And so that's where I'm really going, is that we need to take this a step beyond anything that's been done thus far. And so I'm a long quote, but this is a juicy one. I'm going to read it, and I'll be wrapping up very quickly now. But Richard Feynman, we all know who he is. And so here's one of his most delicious statements. And that is, he said, it's only through refined measurements and careful experimentation that we can have a wider vision. So it's empiricism once again. And then we see unexpected things. We see things that are far from what we would guess, far from what we could have imagined. In other words, they may challenge our assumptions, even our most cherished assumptions. And he adds, if science is to progress, what we need is the ability to experiment. Honesty in reporting results. The result must be reported without somebody saying what they would like the results to have been, which is where dogma comes in and squashes the data, distorts the data, so everybody can keep comfortable if you're a materialist. One of the ways of stopping science would be only to do experiments in the region where you know the law. In other words, don't study psi phenomena. Don't study parapsychology, because you don't know the law. And it's scary, and you might question more assumptions than you feel comfortable with. But that's exactly how you stop science, by ignoring such studies that show empirical evidence for reincarnation, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, and so forth. This is exactly where we don't know the law. This should be having hundreds of millions of euros every year, because it's probably the most important branch of psychology. And the United States, I know, you can be certain that you'll get no money at all. Zero. From the National Science Foundation, from the National Institute of Mental Health, and so forth, because they don't support research that challenges their assumptions. And science is money-driven now. It's a branch of capitalism. Richard Feynman, he's giving us the ideal. So however we, the scientific community, fail to live up to it, at least the ideal is there, advocated by a great champion of science. He says, but experimenters, he's referring to ideal experimenters, search most diligently and with the greatest effort in exactly those places where it seems most likely that we can prove our theories wrong. Psi research, parapsychology, working with contemplative conditions and Taoist and Hindu and so forth as collaborators, listening to them. What have you discovered? What have you seen? How can you test it? How can we work together to find out what is true? Because the strengths of contemplative inquiry are exactly complementary to the strengths of modern science. So Buddhism has a tremendous amount to benefit from the encounter with science to overcome deep strains of dogmatism in Buddhism. And science has potential to receive tremendous benefit from Buddhism and other traditions because there is such deep-rooted dogmatism in science. They can liberate each other. And so science and spirituality, and not scientism versus religious fundamentalism, which is a dead-end street in all directions. So he concludes, in other words, we're trying to prove ourselves wrong as quickly as possible, because only in that way can we find progress. I think that should be on the above the door of every science department in the world, because there's a great ideal. And it's a great ideal in Buddhism as well. It's a great ideal for anyone who's seriously interested in truth. Last slide, and we're finished, and we'll get to our conversation. But I think it's quite obvious that there have been two true revolutions in physics. Galileo started the first one, Max Planck, Einstein, Niels Bohr, and so forth. That wasn't a bump on the road. That was a revolution in the 20th century. What happened in quantum mechanics and relativity, there's no going back. If you'd like to be a 19th century physicist, that's fine, but it's called history of science. you can't live there anymore, right? You cannot ignore the evidence from these great revolutions in physics in the 20th century. Once you've understood what Darwin discovered, Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, you cannot go back to thinking all species are static. You're just ignorant. You can't go back. We've had no such comparable revolution in the mind sciences. We could have been, except for dogmatism snuffed out the light and insisted the only kind of research that will be tolerated and funded will be research that completely in accordance with the methodological and ideological constraints of scientism. So we're living still in a dark age, and that's what William James was saying. We're living in a dark age. For the fundamental issues about the nature of the mind, its role in nature, its multiple dimensions, dark age. Where we see in the media everywhere, mind is equated with brain. The brain is the agent, not you, and the mind is just fluff. So we need to move ahead. Move ahead in the same spirit as Galileo, Darwin, William James, the great ones, who are truly open and fearless, and who didn't mind facing the Inquisition of the dogmatists who had the power, the reins of power during their era. And so what I'm suggesting, there's a very clear strategy, nothing really original here, but I'm putting things together. We need to, for the first time, implement rigorous, sustained training in first-person contemplative methods to complement third-person scientific methods. And that is, bring the first-person perspective, the introspective, elevate it to a level of scientific rigor and replicability and intersubjective corroboration and validation. It can be done. I've just led a one-week retreat, tell exactly how to do it. And it's been there for a couple of thousand years. Don't have to reinvent the Dharma wheel. So there's the first one, is let there be complementarity between the first-person and third-person methods. And then when it comes to consciousness, don't just study normal and brain-damaged people, normal people and mentally ill people, which is overwhelmingly what mainstream psychology does. Look at the broadest bandwidth. Explore the broadest possible range of states of consciousness, including the most profoundly mystical and psi phenomena and so forth, integrating the methods of psychology, including parapsychology, neuroscience, let it throw off the shackles of materialism and contemplative inquiry. And for this, and then I come home to my baby, I saw you use the word space, what was it, inner space station. So interesting. We have not collaborated on this point. Inner space station, I like it. My word is contemplative observatory. It's not a contemplative laboratory that means you're looking down into a petri dish, something very small and local. A contemplative observatory is you're attending to the space of the mind, and the space of the mind is no less vast than the space that astronomers and cosmologists are studying. But you access it from the inside out. And so contemplative observatories, well, how is that different than simply more retreat centers? We have a lot of retreat centers already. And in the following way, that it's going to be, we're seeking to create one right now. We're in the process of creating one in Tuscany. We found the perfect site. And a contemplative observatory where it's not going to be unreligious or anti-religious, we're simply going to be overwhelmingly emphasizing the scientific elements of contemplative inquiry in the Buddhist tradition. By training attention in ways that anybody could do, religious or non-religious, and then venturing into contemplative inquiry called vipassana that anyone can do, religious or non-religious, have a group of people with the most skillful guidance available, training for 5,000 hours, 10,000, or make it their life vocation, as we have scientists all over the world, they're spending their whole lives in research. On the one hand, so really focusing in on the telescope of the mind, developing samadhi, and using that telescope of the mind to explore the deep space of consciousness. That would be innovative already. I don't know of any center that's doing that. But now let's make it unique to the second power. And that is, as soon as the door opens, invite in scientists. Open-minded, critical scientists, psychologists, neuroscientists, but physicists also. With physicists of the stature of Bernard, then for heaven's sake, we can't leave you out. Don't want to leave you out. Because you have a skill set no psychologists have, no neuroscientists have. It's unique, and the Buddhists don't have it either. And so bring multiple people to the table, philosophers, physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists, in a completely collaborative way. Let's draw from the strengths of each of these disciplines and trigger the first revolution in the mind sciences in history. And William James said this will be the greatest breakthrough in all of science. I think he's right. And I think we're very close. With people like Bernard here, and there are other scientists, Peter, decades of this kind of research, and others I've had the privilege to know. I think we're very, very close now to tipping, the tipping point, and really breaking this out open into the realm of empiricism and taking these issues, what happens at death, what are the origins of mind, what are the potentials of the mind, taking this out of simple belief systems, such as materialism and religious belief systems, and bringing it out into the world of empirical research. That's my vision. Thank you, Bernard. Thank you, all of you. Let's start a conversation.